There is no anti-mimetics division. Part 4. Last time in the story, we were properly introduced to Adam Wheeler, Marion's forgotten husband that she banished from her life and the Foundation's to keep him safe. The war that the anti-mimetics division is unknowingly involved in is growing hotter, and there are undoubtedly going to be more casualties. Let's take a look. Chapter 9, Ojai. Foundation agent George Barson is monolithic, nearly 2 meters tall and rectangular-shouldered, like a Bruce Timm cartoon. He is bald, bearded, and immaculately presented. His suit is tailored. There are few which will fit him off the rack. He arrives at the Green Place first thing after dawn, 6 o'clock. The address is isolated, an acre or two of ill-maintained scrubland off a spur of the main highway north out of Ojai. Barson is part of the Foundation's Anomalous Religious Expressions Division. They do cults. Green is not the name of the cult which Barson is here to confront, but a code name. Barson doesn't know the real name. At the briefing last night, it was explained that there are legitimate security reasons to use code names instead of true names here, but those reasons were not explained. Barson, no fool, took this to mean that there is some form of cognitohazard surrounding the true names, or a memory-clouding phenomenon which makes them impossible to record. Or, and he's dealt with Foundation research staff for far too many years to not consider this, somebody just straight up forgot to record the real names and is trying to cover for themselves. If there's an SCP number, he hasn't been told it. The house is an ugly white sprawl, one story, wood construction, no two windows alike in design, decaying. There are piles of junk, lumber, rusted vehicle components, drums of filthy green water. Willow and sycamore trees are encroaching from 2.5 sides, drizzling leaves and seeds and miscellaneous biological gunk all over the roof, clogging the gutters. Through the windows, only closed curtains and blinds are visible. The front door is standing ajar. Barson proceeds inside, cautiously. The entrance opens almost directly onto a large lounge-slash-diner-slash-kitchen area. The room is darkened, light mostly spilling from the entrance door. Barson leaves it open, and feeling its way around the edges of the window coverings. The place is dirty and smells of mold. The still air is like an oven, and it's extremely quiet except for the faint, animated sound of someone talking away down the hall, words not entirely clear. Wasps, and yeah, it's going to be sharp inside. When you're made to move, that's tlo krul dilth you'll bleed from. Barson goes down the hall, passing a wall decoration which was once a mirror but has been completely painted over in black. After a brief search, during which he ascertains that the rest of the house is empty, he comes to the final room. The door is closed, but the focused rambling is coming from inside. At home, it's super easy. I'm going to give you something. An easy 2-part project for you to take away. And don't forget, alth amth below. Part 1. Find someone weaker than you. Barson knocks, loudly, twice. The patter stops. Nothing else is heard. Barson opens the door. The room is dark, its window blocked with a thick curtain. There's a computer desk in the corner opposite the door, about as cluttered as a desk can realistically get, strewn with partially disassembled hardware, USB keys, chocolate wrappers, scraps of paper, ballpoint pens. There's a gaming mouse, unable to move, for junk. There's a good quality video camera setup, a monitor, video feeds on the monitor, dust. There's a cheap, skeletal swivel chair in front of the monitor, and a young man of about 20 slouched uncomfortably in the chair. He is skinny, with discolored, pale skin, which Barson thinks could be caused by malnutrition. He has what was at one point a stylish, fashionable haircut, but is now in some disrepair, and when he turns around, Barson sees that he has dark rings around his eyes. It looks as if he hasn't slept in a year. He reeks. The room is filled with that odor, almost thick enough to see. In the same way that the anomalous viral/religious phenomenon, the cult gathering around and above this young man like an anvil cloud, is named Green, he himself is named Red. Barson greets him and says that they saw his streams. The youth pulls his headphones down and asks who the hell he is. Barson introduces himself, but he's cut off as Red launches out of his chair like a rabid greyhound from a cage. He comes fist first, losing the headphones. Barson shifts his weight slightly to his left, leaning away from the punch. He catches Red's arm and pulls it forward, violently, deflecting the attack's momentum and bringing the youth teeth first into the doorframe. Red stumbles back, crouching. He finds his footing swiftly. Froth is developing at the corners of his mouth, mixing with blood. Scrabbling around the junk on the floor, he puts his hand on a soldering iron. As Red comes forward again, Barson wastes a critical split second trying to trace the iron's cable to figure out whether it's plugged in and hot or not. It's not, but that's enough distraction that Red gets right up there, driving the iron up into Barson's gut with both hands. There's an electronic screech and a spark of orange light. The iron holes Barson's shirt, but skitters off his abdomen, opening a long tear. There's bare skin underneath. His shield is invisible, partly mythical, and protects his seemingly exposed head just as well as the rest of him. Barson takes Red in a headlock. Some haphazard kicking ensues, less well choreographed. Red has a demon's energy behind him, but Barson has, to be blunt, arrived prepared. In a few more moves, Red is disarmed, stunned, flat on his back, and good for nothing. Barson takes stock. The number of genuine fight-for-your-life fights he's been in is still in single digits. This one ranks about in the middle. 15 seconds of activity. Both of them made mistakes. A learning experience. Barson says that he'll dispense with the introductions then, and remarks that the live-streaming vector was novel. They hadn't seen that before. Very effective compared to the generic self-help book and walled compound model. He gets 1 point for originality out of 10, but they predicted it decades back and they had the containment procedures ready to go. They have people at the streaming services, and as they speak, they're locking him out of his account. They're using his own channels to distribute inoculation codes. Barson tries to tidy his shirt up, but it's not going to work. Since Red is the source, a simple inoculation code would glance off. Physical intervention is required. He reaches inside his jacket, where he has a perfectly serviceable gun, which he elected to leave where it is for this confrontation, and produces a device not unlike an ophthalmologist's scope. He kneels, lifts Red's right eyelid, and aims the scope at it, projecting a brilliant white spot of light, which bathes the entire eye and causes it to lock open. Almost all of Red's musculature locks up as well, effectively pinning him to the floor. His teeth clench. Barson says that this man is innocent, and nobody can deserve what you've done to him. Release him, and leave this reality forever. Through gritted teeth, Red asks again who the hell he is. Barson pushes another button, changing the projected light pattern from a pure white disc into a complex spiral star design in red and blue. There's a crack, like ribs being forced apart, and the youth screams. It doesn't sound like Red. It's a full-body scream, anguished and hopeless and as loud as he's physically able to make it. It comes up from his belly and goes on, flat out, until he runs out of breath and gasps and does it again, arching his back and clawing at the floor. After the second full breath, he cools down to a sobbing wail. He begs Barson not to send him back, and Barson assures him that he won't. Red says that he can't see and asks who's there. Barson assures him that he'll get his sight back, and that his name's George. Red says that there's a pit, and it always gets worse. It doesn't stop, There's no bottom. He babbles incoherently for a moment, and then trails off. His eyes dance blindly. Barson tells him that he's in a really bad place right now. Something has gone wrong, and that thing, that horrific thing which went wrong, has found him and abducted him and replaced him. It's out here now, using his skin as a finger puppet, walking him around, making him talk, replicating. That nightmare he's having is being had by 100,000 people right now. That's the bad news. The good news is that they caught him, and he can still see the youth in there, and there's a good chance that they can get him out. Red questions him, saying a good chance, but Barson cuts him off and tells him to focus on the red and blue spiral. He still has the scope pointed into the youth's eye. Red replies that he can't see anything, but Barson explained that that's because he's not directly connected to this optic nerve anymore. His mind is locked inside something which is, though. He can't see the spiral, but somehow he knows what it looks like. He can sense its shape, like a pattern of heat on the back of your hand. Barson's voice is becoming slower, taking on a hypnotic rhythm. The spiral idea is going in, spreading and flourishing, occupying more space. The more he thinks about the spiral, the more he realizes that he can't think about anything but the spiral. Red seems to have nothing to say to this. His breathing stabilizes. Barson continues and says that his thoughts are slowed. The spiral fills him up, recursively, like ice crystals, until he can't move. His brain knows it's being poisoned. Even though he's blind, he feels a reflexive need to look away or block out what he's seen. A long enough exposure is fatal. There is a long, heavy pause, during which Barson does nothing but shine poisonous light into the young man's eye, while studying that brightly illuminated eye himself, tracking the progress of the ocular response, waiting for a particular tell. It's not a clear-cut thing. There's a small amount of guesswork. He waits until he's sure. Finally, he releases the button on the scope, shutting it off. The youth is now completely inert. Barson stands up, knees creaking. He relaxes, sighs, his shoulders untense a little. He puts the scope away. You can think of this as mimetic chemotherapy, he says, mostly to himself, to fill dead air. The young man can only hear pink fuzz now. The spiral symbol is an elementary cognito poison. A long exposure is fatal, but a just barely non-fatal exposure is recoverable. He will recover from this poison, and Red cannot. He will survive, and Red will die, because he is an intelligent, creative human being, and Red is... He reflects on his briefing, and what he knows of the green phenomenon, and the 100,000 people suffering and raving inside it right now. They're in all parts of the globe. He has seen some photographs of what takes place in homes occupied by Red's appalling messages. He's heard a strictly limited amount of highly redacted audio. Dispassionate people make better field decisions. That's the rule he was always taught. But remaining dispassionate is harder on some days than others. Red is a piece of shit, he finishes. Barson potters around the room for a little while, taking a closer look at some of the computer hardware. Nothing notable there, although he finds a stand for the soldering iron. There's also a narrow camp bed in the room, with a bedraggled sleeping bag. He clears the sleeping bag away and loads the youth onto the camp bed, in a recovery position. He pulls the curtain open. It's an obnoxiously sunny day, and the sun is aimed right in through that window. Finally, Barson picks up the swivel chair and settles into it on the far side of the room, where he can keep an eye on his patient. He pulls a Foundation-issued phone from his pocket, along with a horrendously tangled pair of cheap earbuds, which he begins to untangle. He relaxes into his monologue. It's not as if anybody is listening. The fact is, he didn't need to come here. There's more than one way to physically intervene when something like green comes around. The original plan when they found out about him was to use an orbital laser cannon on the top of his head. They can do that, from time to time. His house would be a circle of scorched timber, with him a burnt marshmallow at the middle of it. That's their latest methodology for dealing with virulent, single-culpability memetic anomalies. They do it at arm's length, at the longest possible distance, unblinkingly and unfeelingly, and to hell with the details. It's brutal, impersonal, very expensive in orbital laser maintenance. They say to themselves that it's effective, and maybe it is. He's not at that level, so he doesn't get to see the statistics. But what he does know is that they can always do better. He looked at the file, and he looked at him, and he took a long shot. Honestly, he's a very small guy in the grand scheme, but he stood up in a pretty intense meeting with people who he doesn't really have the authority to say anything to, and he said to them that there's a completely innocent kid at the center of this. He doesn't deserve this. At minimum, they've got to make the gesture. A shadow passes across the room. Barson looks around briefly, but whatever it is has gone. He thinks nothing of it and continues. He also said that if it works, it'll save them a boatload of money. He thinks that part was the part which got their attention, but he got the thumbs up, so here he is. Trying to save his life the hard way instead of just atomizing it. It'll probably take all day, but don't worry. He has podcasts. He finishes untangling the earbuds and screws the first of them into his left ear. Red then says that his people must really hate him. Barson draws, late. Obviously, nobody should be able to talk right now, but the real reason he draws late is that the comment lands. It should just pass him by, but there is a sharp, spiteful element of truth to it. Truthfully, nobody was a fan of the idea. Barson has been saying for a long time, with gradually increasing volume to gradually increasing senior Foundation overseers, that a chat beats a fight. He's been ignored over and over. Yesterday, when they finally said that he could try it, it was grudgingly. And so a momentary flicker of foul suspicion appears. Did they know? Did they really just kill him? They didn't. He knows, of course, they didn't. But it's too late. As he fumbles the gun out, Red has already sat up, grinning like a ventriloquist puppet, and turned his head to look right at Barson. They make eye contact, and this time Red's eyes are open all the way, allowing Barson to see straight through to what's on the other side. Green comprehension leaps out of the pit at Barson and grounds itself in the back of his skull. He recoils instinctively, breaking the connection and covering his eyes. He stumbles, falling backwards out of the chair and into the corner of the room. His orange, crystalline shield fluctuates, panicking in its own way because of what just passed through it. Intermittently, it turns impermeable, cutting off Barson's frantic breathing. Then it snaps off and dies. Barson doesn't have the training to fully comprehend the idea complex he was just exposed to. He has a basic level of practical memetics training. He can administer the spiral treatment and a few others, and protect himself from certain attacks which would knock a generic human over like a domino. But he's an entry-level practitioner, not a specialist, not a scientist. The sheer scope of Green is beyond his ability to comprehend. He feels like one of the men Lewis Slotin irradiated, a demon core criticality witness. He knows he's dead. The only question is how long it's going to take. Red swings his legs off the bed and stands, keeping his grin fixed on Barson. He remarks on the spinning red and blue light and asks how backwards he is. He seemed to grow larger and to sink backwards into space. A hole where a human should be. Barson finds he can't make himself move out of the corner. It's like he's pinned. There's a creeping, staticky numbness in his hands. He understands his error now. He might as well have tried to poison the ocean. He sees the whole thing, Red's grotesque vision for the world, his slash its immense, vicious promise. The rot is everywhere. Those 100,000 infected are a foretaste. The spores are flourishing secretly in every aspect of reality, in people's lungs, in their minds, their words, in the soil, in the sky. Maggots and cancers and star signals. How can anyone think like that? How can anyone want that? There's no distinction between Red and whoever that original human was. There's no one to rescue. It was a damn ruse. It was voluntary. Barson manages to ask if Red made this happen. It didn't abduct him. He invited it. Hacked his own soul in half and offered the pieces up, for no reason at all. He's latched himself onto the front of something unimaginable. He can't comprehend how badly this is going to end, as he's murdered himself. Red advances on him. Gun. Barson's mind is disintegrating, but it gets that one word out. Gun. It's on the floor between them, gleaming in the shaft of orange light pouring out of the window. Barson fights himself and wins, and lunges for it, only then finding that the creeping numbness in his extremities isn't just affecting his hands, it's affecting his own ability to perceive them. He doesn't know that it's a minor anti-mimetic clouding effect. All he knows is that there's a stump at the end of his arm. Both arms. The gun is inoperable. All he can do is push it around the floor. He shouts, miserably and helplessly. Red laughs and doesn't even bother to kick it away. Barson manages to say that the Foundation will stop him, speaking it like a mantra. Red cocks his head, as if he knows the word Foundation from somewhere. He asks if all of them are as weak as Barson. Comprehension goes both ways. Barson dimly understands what Red represents, which means Red, in turn, dimly understands what Barson represents. Red perceives the power structures which dispatched Barson into this hated burrow. Red perceives the shadows of the people at the streaming services, and the mobile task force Barson doesn't know about, skulking out at the property's perimeter waiting for a go order which will never come. Red perceives the 4 or 5 brutal, impersonal suits seated at the top of the operation, webbing it together. One of them is toying absently with their laser strike keystick, twirling it around the back of their thumb over and over, dropping it. That's as far through headspace as Red can search, because that's the limit of the people who know about him. It. Red. That's the hit list. A shadow blots the sun out again, the same one as before, for longer this time. Red looks out through the window, giving it a curt nod, and it departs. Barson slumps to one side, dead up to the shoulders now. Conscious that any of these words could be his last, he says that he thinks he's in control, but it's going to kill him too. They can get him out. He can help them contain it. Red crouches, still grinning, and tells Barson to look at him. Barson looks. He doesn't have a choice. It hurts. Red makes sure he is being heard loudly and clearly, and says, "No." Barson whispers, "Zayin 346, Samek Shin." Red blinks and says, "What?" Something bleeps, and Barson says, "A star, a star." Red swears and begins looking around, suddenly genuinely alarmed. He lost track of Barson's phone. He finds it beneath the bed and snatches it up. There's a voice authentication interface, and authentication is nearly complete. He tells it to stop, cancel, undo, but nothing happens, as it's the wrong voice. He drops the phone and scrabbles for the gun. Barson says, "Zelochi, Enora, fire." Red puts a bullet through the phone and a second through Barson's skull. He looks up at the ceiling, waiting, still alarmed. and he waits, but nothing else happens. Chapter 10, Immemorial. Marion Wheeler has just finished a scheduled inspection of SCP-8473 and is about to go for a cigarette. Someone is running up to meet her outside SCP-8473's containment unit. Marion recognizes her as Dr. Eli Moreno, a trainee field researcher who joined the Antimimetics Division only 6 months ago. She asks her if she can help her with something. Moreno interlocks her fingers nervously. She is a full head taller than Marion, and half her age, with scraggly hair and exceedingly thick glasses. She lacks experience, but she is very smart, and she's learning very fast. In another year, she'll be among the best people the division has, or has ever had, and Marion is looking forward to that. Marion loves nothing more than competent people. Still, as the pause lengthens, that day of competence seems to be in the future. Marion remarks that she normally expects her people to get to the point a little quicker than this. Moreno blurts out that there's a stone in the forest behind the site. It's monumental, like a skyscraper, and it blots out the sun. She asks Marion if she knows what she's talking about, which Marion does. Moreno says that she's never seen it before, and she doesn't understand how it's possible that she never saw it. It casts a shadow across the whole site. She asks if it was always there, which it was, and she sees it because she took her first routine dose of ops-grade Nestix this morning. Moreno seems alarmed, asking if that's how it works. Something that big can just be right there and they don't see it. Marion says, yeah, and checks her watch, mentally moving some scheduled commitments around. Extend this smoke break to the rest of the afternoon. Leave the scheduled inspection of SCP-3125 where it is. Review promotion cases after the gym instead of before. Evening meal, at this rate, never. Moreno, suffocating under the weight of follow-up questions, finally asks what it is. Marion gestures to her left, down the corridor, indicating that she is about to walk and that Moreno should follow her. She says that she'll show her. In the database, it's SCP-9429. Moreno hasn't read the entry. She doesn't have access. The stone is a single, unbroken, 91 by 91 by 147 meter vertical cuboid of ancient, weathered, dark basalt. It sits at a very slight angle, leaning fractionally to the north. Its regular angles clearly mark it as a carved object, a human-made artifact. It rises out of the forest to the east of Site 41 and dominates, not to say obliterates, the views in that direction from the windows of the site's main block. It is, by volume, massively bigger than the site itself, even including its underground extents. It looms. It's absolutely unmissable. The idea that anyone could fail to notice it for any period of time is, Marion has to admit, more than a little unnerving. Marion leads Moreno up the short forest track to the stone's perimeter, and then right, following its perimeter, in its shadow. It's a wet day, and rain is dripping from the very top edge of the cube, as well as from the conifers which grow right up beside it. The rain makes a constant white hiss, deadening other sounds. She explains that there's a weak antimimetic clouding effect surrounding it. To most people, it's effectively invisible. Moreno has been up to the top of some of these other hills, she's sure. She should have seen it clearly from up there as well, but she looked straight past it. That's normal. There's a related effect which removes people's memories after they've visited the stone. That effect is much stronger, and it'll cut right through both of their Nestic drug regimens. Moreno asks if they'll forget all about this then. Marion holds up a battered little notebook and a cheap blue ballpoint. Moreno understands. She's carrying a notebook and pen as well. Information suppression is a complicated spectrum. Sometimes a written note is the only thing which will make it out of a zone which suppresses memories, electronic data, radio signals, and even audible sound. Alongside the mandatory Foundation-issue brick phone, Many antimimetics division operatives habitually carry some combination of an instant camera, a mechanical tape-driven dictaphone, a notebook, a walkie-talkie. Not that Moreno is expecting to need anything today. Marion continues and says that of course one side effect of the clouding is that she doesn't exactly remember the way. She guesses they could set up signposts, but somehow it never gets done. Not because of anti-mimetic effects, just plain laziness. They come to a passage in the side of the stone. In fact, it is not a passage, but a tremendously deep groove cut all the way from the top of the cube to its base, a slot with a thin line of overcast sky visible overhead, and steps leading up. Marion begins to climb, and Moreno follows. They climb in silence for some minutes. Moreno stops a few times to write down a note or two, hunching over to shield her notebook from the drizzle. Then she hurries to catch up with Marion, who maintains a steady, indifferent pace. Sometime after Moreno has lost count of the stepped groove makes a 90-degree turn to the left and continues to ascend. Marion stops here, above Moreno, and turns to quiz her, asking her what she has so far. Moreno asks what this place is, but Marion replies that she should tell her. Moreno hesitates for a moment, uncertain where this is going. She checks her notes. She says that geologically speaking, this stone is an alien. At first, she thought there had been a mountain on this spot which was excavated into this shape by human hands, but the rock itself is wrong. It's different from the mountains and hills near here. You'd have to travel at least 500 kilometers to find basalt like this, which means it must have been excavated elsewhere, maybe carved there and moved here. Marion says nothing, but her demeanor seems to indicate that Moreno is on the right track. She continues, saying that that is impossible. This is a single stone. Judging from its dimensions and density, it must mass north of 3 million tons. That's after carving, and that can't be done. Human civilization cannot move objects of this size, not in a single piece. The technology doesn't exist. Marion says that that's correct, and Moreno just asks how it got here then. Marion replies that that's a good question. Moreno waits. She doesn't have the answer to the question, so she waits for Marion to supply it. But she doesn't. She instead asks what else. Moreno says that it's been engraved, using tools, indicating the walls of the stepped passage. And she noticed the exterior walls are the same. There's a lot of weathering, but here and there between the biological crud, there's this very clear, regular pattern. Tiny vertical rectangles, like a block cursor on an old computer terminal. Or a tombstone in typography, Marion suggests. Moreno blinks and agrees. It's a uniform pattern, very detailed work, which would require quite good tools even by modern standards. She thinks that the pattern is supposed to cover the entire exterior of the stone, and if that's the case, the blocks are so minuscule and the stone is so large that there must have originally been hundreds of millions of them. Marion agrees, and asks if there's anything else. Moreno thinks for a minute. She stares up into the rain, reflecting on the atmosphere that the stone, or sculpture as she supposes it would be better described, projects. Loneliness, quiet, desolation, awe, intimidation, and some fear. Although with that intimidating, fearful atmosphere, there's no sensation of danger, no threat. "We considered ourselves to be a powerful culture," she says aloud. Marion hears this, but asks no follow-up question. Apparently satisfied, she turns and continues climbing the steps, and Moreno follows. The passage makes several more turns, carving out an erratic, squared squiggle. Moreno takes no further notes. Her knees are about ready to explode by the time they reach the top. They emerge, blinking at the light, on a wet, windswept, slightly slanted plateau. There are more of the tiny tombstone indentations underfoot. The edges of the cube are some distance away, but they are not marked. The dark gray surface just ends at a straight line, not far out, and the horizon itself is below it, not visible. This gives Moreno some vertigo, particularly since the surface tilts towards one corner, and the engraved basalt underfoot is slick, wet, and getting wetter. There is a small cluster of Foundation scientific equipment up here, chunky weatherproof units stacked up under a canopy. There's a table, with a rugged, beaten-up computer terminal switched off. Further away is a diesel generator. Marion ignores the equipment and paces away in a different direction, facing away from Moreno and out at the sky, playing with her cigarette lighter, although not actually lighting anything. The lighter is actually a tiny propane burner intended for lighting stoves, given to her by her mother before she died. Marion no longer remembers this. Moreno waits for a while, arms folded for warmth, gradually getting wetter. She doesn't see cover under the canopy, because Marion hasn't. She senses that something is about to happen. Marion is normally quite poised and difficult to read, but she looks apprehensive, upset even. Focused intently on the lighter flame, Marion seems to be unable to look her in the eye, as if she doesn't want to push through with the next part of whatever this is actually supposed to be. Orientation? Initiation? Hazing? What was that about getting to the point? It's a memorial, Moreno says. Marion snaps the lighter shut and pockets it, moderately impressed. Only moderately, though. She says that that's right. Of course, she practically told her that when she mentioned tombstones. Moreno then asks, how many anti-mimetic wars have there been? That gets her. She swears and says so much for slow-burning theatrics. She asks Moreno if someone told her, or she read the entry, but Moreno looks at her shoes and says not really. She's never seen this place before, and she was just guessing. Marion says that she looks embarrassed, that she hit the right answer 30 minutes before she was expecting her to. She thinks that she's shown Marion up, but Marion tells her to keep operating at that level. Don't slow up for her benefit, or for anyone's. It's important. Moreno asks if she'll tell her why they're here, for what she hopes will be the final time. In another part of her mind, a fatal chain of calculations starts. Marion explains that the problem is that every single person in the world with reliable access to high-grade Nestic medication works for her, here, and the division is pitifully understaffed. There are 40 of them, including the two of them, and 40 pairs of eyes is not enough. They cannot look at enough of the world at once. There is an appallingly large percentage of the world which no human has ever properly looked at. This is unbearably limiting to all forms of anti-mimetic research. Anti-mimetic biology, paleontology, cosmology, archaeology, all barely exist. They are nowhere. Nevertheless, they have seen this culture's cities. One or two still exist, and pure dumb luck is how they found them. A division researcher takes a vacation, drives across Nevada while still on the dopes, and sees something on the horizon. That sort of thing. The cities are physically ruined, and there are heavy anti-mimetic effects shrouding them which make them nearly impossible to study, even for them. Large, simple things like this stone survived better, but even so. They think this stone was one of the last things they built before they died out. They were human, and were probably significantly more technologically advanced than we are. They existed tens of thousands of years ago, perhaps hundreds of thousands. They can't know for sure. It's difficult to determine what really happened to them because their entire cultural memeplex was lethally irradiated. Their core cultural concepts, the things they created and stood for and valued highly, can never be known or propagated again. They think an idea stole into their culture which they did not have adaptations to defend against. A complex of ideas. A meme-plectic slash Keter class end of world scenario. Marion pauses, letting the rain patter for a significant moment. Moreno asks if they all just forgot, all of them that survived the war and became modern humanity. They just looked away and walked away and moved on. Marion says yes, and Moreno staggers, vertigo swelling up and briefly getting the better of her. Hundreds of millions of people died and they just forgot. Is that what she wanted to show her? Does she want her to write that down? Marion says yes, write it down. It's the first thing she's learning today. Humans can forget anything. It's okay to forget some things, because we are mortal and finite, but some things they have to remember. It's important that they remember. Write to herself something which will make her remember. Moreno nods. It's raining too heavily, so she retreats under the canopy and uses the table. Even so, a few raindrops spatter her notes. She writes intently and rapidly for some time. What she writes is rushed and unrefined, with large parts crossed out. She wonders how she'll react when she reads it for the first time. After a while, Marion joins her under the canopy. Moreno, staring at her notes, asks her, as if she doesn't already know the answer, what the second thing is. Marion says that it's possible that their culture had an equivalent to the Foundation. It may even have had an anti-mimetics division. If they did, their Foundation and their anti-mimetics division failed them. It's a big reality, and a big Foundation. There's a lot of Keters, and a lot of Keter-class scenarios. So maybe the end of the world will be some other division's problems. And yes, a big part of the job they hired her for is basic research. Lab work, as safe as it gets. And yes, it's been thousands of years, and it may be thousands of years more. But maybe it won't. And maybe it will be their problem. To answer her original question, there has been one anti-mimetics war that they know of, potentially others that they don't know of. And there is undoubtedly one to come. Moreno says nothing. She looks dismayed, broken. She's right to be, and Marion is familiar with the reaction. This is indeed part of every new anti-mimetics division operative's orientation. The magnitude of responsibility can be hard to handle. It should be. Marion welcomes her to the anti-mimetics division, and says that this is her first day. Moreno writes for some time longer, while Marion waits, silently. The rain doesn't let up. Moreno eventually asks what the idea was. Marion explains that it was SCP-9429-A. They isolated the memeplex itself in the 70s, and they have it on a slab in a Vegas room, basement level 2. It's mostly harmless now. It's so culturally alien to modern humans as to be nearly incoherent. She says to think of Egyptian hieroglyphs, which Moreno says she can read. She asks if Marion is saying it couldn't come back, but Marion says that in that form, it's highly unlikely. Moreno then points at something far away in the sky, and Marion looks, but doesn't see anything but overcast sky and rain. She asks what Moreno sees, as under heavy nestic doses, some people say they see ghosts here. They even have some supposed interview logs, but personally she thinks their veracity is dubious. Moreno replies that it doesn't look like a ghost. It looks like an anorexic kaiju, a pillar made of spiders. It's taller than this stone, at least twice as tall, and it's coming here. She asks if this is normal, but Marion says no, her mind already racing through the checklist. Moreno asks what it is, but Marion doesn't know. She asks if this is part of the hazing, but Marion says no, and she will never lie to her. An anti-mimetically cloaked entity, which looks as monstrous as Moreno is describing, has an approximately 0% chance of being benign. They need support. Wheeler finds that her phone has no signal. Checking Moreno's is pointless, she already knows. The only way to get a message out of here is with a written note. A paper airplane, thrown off the top into the woods. Moreno says that it's bending down, and she thinks it's looking at her. There isn't even a hole in the rain which Marion can perceive. Moreno says that its head is gigantic, 10 meters wide. It has graspers and arthropod legs all over it. Dozens of eyes, some of which are blinded. There's someone riding it. Marion tells her to describe the rider. Moreno describes him as being a Caucasian male, 20s, skinny, wearing jeans and trainers, with dirty brown hair in need of a haircut. He's been shot, and he's bleeding all over, but he doesn't seem to notice. In the liver, and again in the throat, but he's smiling. He says that no, that never happened. Marion spends a split second wondering whether the gunshot wounds are intentionally creepy detailing or whether the man is genuinely using some kind of advanced anti-mimetic power to ignore a mortal wound. If so, how? And how he originally sustained it? More urgent questions are afoot, though. She asks Moreno if he sees her, to which Moreno says yes. She then asks if he can see Marion or hear her. Moreno is transfixed and starting to look genuinely frightened, and says that he wants to know who she's talking to. Marion tells her not to tell him. He doesn't get information about them. She pulls her walkie-talkie from her waist, sets it to broadcast an emergency beacon, turns and hurls it overarm as far as she possibly can, in the direction of the Site 41 main building. With luck, it'll land intact in the forest, outside the suppression zone cast by SCP-9429, summoning a mobile task force. She tells Moreno to ask him who he is. Moreno is standing very still, with her arms clamped rigidly at her side. She asks him and says that he says he's nearly finished. He says he's going to kill her. Marion replies, like hell, and says that they're running for it, back down the steps. If they can get to the perimeter of the stone, it'll flush their memories. Moreno says that she can't move, and Marion tries hauling on one of her arms, but she can't be moved. She yells for her to put one foot in front of the other, but Moreno just says that it's got a hold of her. She's goggle-eyed and starting to hyperventilate. Marion disengages and surveys the situation. She can't see or touch any grasping spider legs, or the monumental face which Moreno can't look away from, or the rider. But she believes Moreno that they're there, real, for some value of real. She claps one hand to her side, but of course she isn't carrying her sidearm, because this is a safe SCP on a safe site. Not that it even makes a difference when this mythical rider is able to laugh off gunshot wounds. There aren't enough options in front of her. She very badly wants to swear, and bites down hard on her tongue. Moreno screams, and Marion shouts at her not to look at it, but to look at her. Moreno says that she can't, and Marion tells her that she's stronger than this, but she disagrees. Marion says that she's the best they have, and she's not making that up. She's seen this thing when nobody else could. That makes her smarter and stronger. She can fight it. Moreno just says that it hates them so much. She can't think through it. She can't see. She begs. Marion circles behind her, plants one hand on her shoulder for stability, and punches her behind the ear. Moreno sags in place, then falls forward to her knees. Marion is just about able to catch her before her skull connects with the ground. But she didn't hit her hard enough, and she's unconscious only for a second. She struggles as she comes back, like waking from a nightmare into another nightmare. She clutches at Marion's hand. She can't scream, and her heart stops. Marion rolls her over and administers CPR, but without equipment there's very little chance of her restarting Moreno's heart. Nobody's coming. She didn't throw the walkie-talkie far enough. It's almost 15 minutes before she gives up. And then Marion is collapsed against the wall of the passage, on the next to last step, about to leave SCP-9429's field of influence, trying to figure out what in the hell she can possibly write to herself. What the hell was that thing? All Moreno did was think of it, and it killed her. She was as good as any of them, as capable as she was ever going to be, and she wasn't good enough. How do you fight an anti-mimetic monster which only eats the best anti-mimeticists? You could try to build some kind of counter-meme, but you'd need to be shielded while you worked on it. You'd need a hermetically sealed, self-sustaining lab as big as an arcology. Like the ones Bart Hughes used to build. Like the one under Site 41. God, how long have they been fighting this thing? There's a rustling behind her, and she turns to look. Far away up the steps is the rider Moreno described. A scrawny young man with a hostile frown and two steadily oozing gunshot wounds. His shoes are soaked in blood. He calls out her name and says that he owes her for the lake. Marion stands up. She doesn't know what lake he's talking about, but she says nothing. The rider gestures, and blue and brown and black spiders of all sizes cascade around the corner, flooding the passageway up to his knees, pouring over his shoulders, tumbling down towards Marion. They make a strange, organic rustling as they pour, like wet leaves. There must be millions of them. The spiders would probably be much more effective if she was at all afraid of them. It's too bad, as she's just learned a great deal about this entity, that they have history together, and that it personally dislikes her, and that it apparently has a humanoid mouthpiece and a lousy imagination. But she has only a second before the cascade of arachnids overcomes her, and that's not enough time to even write a single word. Moreno's death, then, was for nothing. She steps backwards, over the threshold. The rain is finally easing off. Marion lights a cigarette and heads back to the main building. It's almost time for her scheduled inspection of SCP-3125. Two separate tragedies that seem to only confirm that this war is escalating quite a bit, and the anti-mimetics division is certainly not winning. All I can assure you is that we haven't even really gotten to the crazy stuff yet. Stay tuned for the next part.